I know, it's good to see you lads, both in the same room for once. First time ever.
Well,
Finn back in the UK.
Good to be back.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's good to be here in person.
We spent a long time in a variety of rooms yesterday, drinking the day away. So what was started out to be a shopping trip for me ended up in a serious session, and I can't believe I escaped the hangover. Someone up there is looking over me. That's all I can say.
Someone's looking up at me.
You're the only one that really got the bad hangover then, because I was all right this morning, to be fair.
I've been in bed all day and I still feel terrible.
Fucking hell.
You felt rough when you got to the pub yesterday, though, didn't you? You're like, oh, I feel horrible. Should we get a drink? Straight away.
You know, back in the Brum session, man, you ain't in Barcelona anymore. And the dead Spanish session, during the proper land of the session now, ain't you?
Hitting the pub after this or what?
If I didn't have work tomorrow, it would be a serious possibility, I'm not gonna lie. Tis the season to be jolly, tra la 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 la.
But should we start the preamble ramble? This week's gonna be about Birmingham City and Flynn. You and Conor Flynn watched the game as well on the weekend. Although I think he turned it off after probably 60 minutes.
I think if the not third before. Goal.
Yeah,
think,
the yeah. third goal he'd had enough. So what was his kind of reaction? Because like, you know, I feel like my passion has been on the wane for like quite a few years now. Mm-hmm. And just them sort of results, they just really put it into perspective about like, why do I even bother turning on the TV? Do you know what I mean? I don't even know why. And there's people that still go to the games. Mm-hmm. But obviously they're not going to stop going because they're Blues faithful. But it does question. It questions your desire, really, to be a Blues fan sometimes.
Watching them, it seemed like they're not going to be around much longer.
Or just as a team.
Just as a team. Because yeah. Conor, like you said, Conor's been a long-time fan just like you. Miserable watching his team for years. And he said they've got all sorts of money problems. Their people in charge are apparently crooks and things like that. Yeah, he got really upset watching the game. He was fine for the first two goals. When the third one went in, that was it. He was fuming. And I was surprised that he was so surprised, because I was expecting.
Yeah.
I was expecting something like that.
I mean, to be fair to Blackburn, I think they've won the last like five on the bounce. They've snuck up to like third. And Jim's now like fist pump in the air because he's a closet Blackburn fan.
Not even closeted. Unashamed. Yeah. I don't even know who plays for him anymore. I just think about the Morton Gabs Pedersen days and just relive those dreams. But you and Tino, on the back of this game, invited me to my first ever Blues game. And you told me to bring a book, didn't you?
Yeah. So, bring a book, because it's not going to be entertaining on the field, that's for sure. But yeah, it's a pretty sorry state of affairs at the moment. I think, obviously, Bowyer's getting like a hell of a lot of slack, obviously, with his connections with Blues as a player. And I think he has come across pretty well, but he's starting to look a little bit exasperated, really, in his post-match conferences, and I just feel like this is the cycle that Blues have had with managers over the last we've had 8 coaches in the last 8-ish years or whatever. Do you know what I mean? So ever since we've had like the likes of Karanka, I think obviously we had Gary Rowell. That's probably our last like good coach. Mm-hmm. Monk was there for a little bit. He did a pretty good job, but there's just this cycle of like Blues manager comes in. There's this optimism. And then it's like, all right, then we hit a bad run of form. And then it'll be like manager starts to like sort of, the fans start getting on the manager's back and stuff like that. And then moaning about the board. And then the cycle just starts again, new coaching. And then it's just like,
how do you stop this? Because we've seen the impact new coaches can have, the honeymoon period, et cetera, et cetera. How do they keep experiencing the same problems with so many different managers? Is it the club thing? Is it an infrastructure thing? Is it a recruitment thing from the youth players? Is it a combination of all those things?
I would say a combination. It's really hard to put your finger on, really. Why we've had such bad luck with managers. You know, the likes of Karanka, who came in and he got Middlesbrough promoted when he was there. So he came in and he had a pretty good reputation. Do you know what I mean? Everyone was thinking, you know, this could be the guy that's going to, you know, get us to challenging in top six. But, you know, for the last decade, we haven't really, we've really only challenged once. And that was the first season we got relegated under Chris Hughton. I think we finished fourth and made playoffs that year. But since then, we have not even challenged to be in the playoffs. You know what I mean? We've flirted with relegation probably 50% of the years that we've been back in the Championship. And I think there's a growing sort of sentiment amongst Blues fans that potentially getting relegated and clearing all the deadwood would actually be a good thing for Blues. Do you know what I mean? Because a lot of teams do it. They go down to League One and then they find themselves bouncing up two leagues like Brentford have done You know, they were back down in League One. They were up in a championship for a year. But then obviously you can happen the other way. Like you can end up like Luton, who were in the championship about 4 years ago, and I think now they're in the conference. So they dropped like four divisions in sort of 5-6 years. So it's it'd be a bit of a gamble. But for me at the moment, Blues are just like on a, I don't know. It's just there's this little bit of optimism every sort of season for a small amount of time, and it's just the same old story.
Is this compounding your hangover talking about this?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's really helping.
It's helping, mate.
But I mean, obviously Connor's been he's been a fan for years and years and years, and he's had season tickets, and I don't think does he go down anymore?
He doesn't go very often.
So there you go. Yeah. So even he started to lose patience. Even, you know, him and Connor Mole and, you know, all them lads, they were like, devout blue noses, do you know what I mean? They'd go down, they'd go home and away, no matter what the result, and they'd give a clap them off the field, just like the Blues fans did. They still clap the players off the field, even though they lost 4-0. And it's just like, Blues fans, you have to give it to them. Like they have got like this sort of like diehard loyalty, and almost a sort of like, they almost like revel in the idea of it being like, all right, you know, we know we're shit in it, you know what I mean?
They're enablers. That's
yeah. what they are enablers, isn't it?
They're victims of abuse is what they are. You know, it's like an abusive lover going, no, it's going to be different next week, I promise. Yeah. Come back.
He's gonna change. He's going to change.
Blues is going to change.
He kicked me down the stairs last week, but he's sad now. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the problems on the field are not they're not the only thing. There's huge problems off the field. Harley Dean, who was captain 5-6 games ago, he's been told he's going to be going in January. So I don't know what's happened behind the scenes there, but he's been there for, I want to say, 5-6 years now. Made, I'd say, over 100 appearances at least for Blues. I'm not sure the exact figure, but he's been he's sort of the club captain in and out at times, but he's off. I don't know what's happened behind doors. Something has happened between him and Bowie, or, you know, he's told, obviously, his intention to leave. He's had enough. But he's never been a great captain anyway. So I think Troy Deeney's could be the way forward. But how much longer is Deeney going to be there? Do you know what I mean?
I don't know much about who Dean is. But something you said piqued my interest about the things happening off the pitch. Everyone blames these owners. And I've not heard you mention them much today. But everyone likes to put the blame at their doorstep.
It's easy to do that, though, isn't it? I think with the owners. And to be honest, yeah, we don't really know much about the owners. And, you know, there's a lot of owners in their ilk. Like, obviously, they're a Chinese owner. So I don't really know too much about it, really. I'd have to do a little bit more research. But there is a guy on Twitter, and you mentioned it before. His handle's like Al Majir or something like that.
I think
he does a lot of research into what's going on in the sort of and the backroom staff, not the backroom staff, the board and how they're conducting their sort of dealings. And to be honest, they don't really come out. And obviously, we had the CEO Dong Ren. He left his position because like he was just like vilified by the fans. I'm not really sure exactly what he was doing wrong, but they're definitely not they're not pros at running a football club, clearly.
Weren't they getting implicated in money laundering and stuff like that?
That was like when we first got relegated, when we had what was his name, Carson Young.
Yeah.
He was like a bogus like hairstylist or something like.
What a front!
He owned like a chain of like hairdressing places or something.
All of them are empty, just loads of heroin on the floorboards.
This is what I've heard, is that there's some of the owners have all these front companies, that Al Majira guy. Apparently he's gone to China to try and find some of these businesses that they own, and there's nothing there to find.
Oh, mate, we should get this guy on, to be fair. Yeah, I think we should reach out to him and he can give us a real good in-depth sort of about the shady dealings.
I think that'd be pretty cool.
Or he could get us suicided. Two shots to the back of the head. Worst case of suicide ever seen. Yeah.
We'll get Epstein.
Yeah, keep him away from here, mate.
But one thing we can agree on for sure is that, you know, Blues got one win in the last seven. That's relegation form, man. And if they're not careful and they don't make some signings in January, and you know, there's already been talk of, we know that players are leaving, we know Harley Dean's going to go, we know that Riley McGree, and Tino's devastated about this. I'm sort of right, he's not a great player, but
the Australian lad,
he's going to be going back to his parent club in January, so there's no chance of him staying on. And you know, there's been talk about Joby Bellingham, Jude Bellingham's younger brother, about him being snatched up by Borussia Dortmund as well. And obviously he hasn't made any first team appearances yet, but it's another sort of like dagger in the heart for Blue Nose, because, you know, we'd like to see him do what Jude did, come through and, you know, maybe even play 40 games for us, just give us a bit of excitement, see what he's like on the pitch. But looking like he might be snatched, like, you know, out of our hands before he even makes a first team appearance.
Do you reckon he'll get some kind of transfer fee, or because of his age and his lack of first team starts, they'll just take him on a free? Or
I wouldn't be surprised, because I think Jude did something similar. His old man, I think, sort of, you know, ushered Jude to sign a contract, and then Borussia Dortmund come in and they had to pay the fees. I think he could have probably left on a free, potentially, you know, similar to what Jack Grealish did with Villa. In the sort of like year before he moved to Man City. But I think potentially maybe Joby does something like that. I don't know if he's signed his first professional contract yet. I think he's, what is he, 16? No, he must have, because he was on the bench, wasn't he, in a couple of cup games. So, yeah, so maybe he signs a new contract and it has like a release clause in it, and Borussia Dortmund have to pay it. But it would be nice if he sorted out Blues in that respect.
That's cool of his brother to do.
I think he did. Yeah, I think Drew did do something very, very similar.
Really,
yeah.
Cool. But how far did that money go? What did they put it? Like, if it happens again, is it going to do any good?
I mean, who knows, man? Who knows where that money went?
It's mismanagement, isn't it, what's going on at all levels. Like, even from the pitch to the boardroom, it sounds like it's an unfortunate thing for diehard fans to have to deal with, because everyone's got limits. But, you know, it's if you're a glutton for punishment, you're just going to keep showing up no matter what happens, aren't you?
Of course,
really,
right. So it's similar to what fired Mashiri, his situation at Everton. You know, had the money, had the clout, but they put the wrong people in the wrong positions, and that's why their sporting director, their director of football, he left, and he had to take the flak for the bad decisions that he made. At the end of the day, you could have as much money as you possibly want. You know, it's not going to change overnight, and Newcastle fans are finding that out. You know, but then now they've got, in January, they're going to have a lot money to spend. The owners are like worth 10 times what Man City owners are, 300 odd billion or something crazy like that. They have outrageous wealth, do you know what I mean? Because they're basically owned by Saudi Arabia, the state, isn't it? So like Newcastle are just going to be like paying like Kieran Trippier 500 grand a week probably or something. And obviously financial fair play relegation is going to be broken. And then they'll get like a fine.
Oh, they care.
Oh, I know.
Is that what they do? They just get fined and then crack on.
They give.
Yeah, usually. But then the EFL like proper like go hard on you, and like look what's happened with Derby and all their points being deducted and stuff like that. So
completely deserved.
Like there's so many. This company man Flynn, absolutely.
Absolutely. Hit him with the book.
Throw the book at him, Janet.
Throw the book at him, get up.
But let's talk about the dismal sort of the VAR sort of, how can I say, criticism rearing its ugly head again, with the contentious decisions in the Spurs versus Liverpool game.
Is this the foul when he got sent off?
Yeah, this
it
Kane.
Looked, it looked pretty hardcore.
Kane's foul, Robertson got sent off for something not
enough,
too dissimilar,
well,
to be honest.
The Harry Kane's one seemed to be a bit like, was it Rudiger the other week, who was flying about the pitch just with the bit between his teeth, just over-amped and a little bit overexcited, recapturing a bit of that form. He scored a lovely goal, and do you think he was just like a bit hyped up? Like, I think that's pretty much what it was. But how on earth he was still on the pitch after he flew in like that, I have no idea. Proper inconsistent.
I think that's all fans really want. I mean,
what
it was
goal,
great finish from Kane. But and then, you know, he makes that challenge. I'm not sure exactly when it won. Was it just after the second half? But either way, Robertson's one, which was in the second half. For me, it was, there it is, I think it's going to be that on nose end. But Robert's one, I think, was nowhere near as bad. You know, I think Harry Kane's challenge, if he would have left his foot planted, and I think it was on Robertson, wasn't it, the challenge in question?
I believe it was, yeah.
I think if he leaves his, and I can't remember who it was, I think it was one of the ex-referees, if he leaves his foot planted there, potentially, there it is, potentially, if he doesn't jump, like, he ain't walking at Christmas, man. He's spending Christmas in crutches. If he doesn't...
Oh.
For me, and I just don't understand where the consistency is with
that was inches,
challenges.
Wasn't it? That if he, like you say, if his studs stay in the turf, he's looking at like a snap shin or something there.
It's high. He's nowhere near the ball, really, Kane. It's just a reckless challenge. And if that's a yellow, then the Robertson one has to be a yellow as well, because the Robertson one was nowhere near as bad.
The Robertson one to me looked a bit more. What's the word I'm looking for? Not an accident. He looked like he kicked him intentionally.
Oh yeah.
Looked a lot more intentional.
Oh yeah, he blasted him in the leg.
He just kicked him.
Yeah, of course it
was. Robinson's Scottish though.
That's all right.
Yeah. Up the jocks.
So do you think there is a
boom? Look
yeah,
at that.
I mean, for me, they're both reds.
Jose Aldo will be proud reds. Of that man. Absolute leg kick galore. Sick.
You know that first goal we saw a moment ago with the Son and Harry Kane, that assist?
Yeah.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think that's their 36th time they've done that. And that might put them at the most assists goals in Premier League history.
Between each other?
I believe so, yeah.
Even more than SAS, Chris Sutton and Alan Shearer back in the day for Blackburn.
Possibly.
Oh,
I know there was a bet that... that everyone was having last season, and it came up a couple of times. It was like, it was Son to assist Kane for a goal, and Kane to assist Son for a goal. Mm-hmm. And it was like 30, it was like, I think it was like 40-1 to start. And people must have lumped on it, because the next week, it was like 33-1. And then I think it came in again, and it was like 28-1. Yeah. So the bookies were running scared a little bit, because it was like one of these sort of like special offers.
Alisson was immense in this game as well. He pulled off some wicked saves, man.
And there's also two big penalty decisions in the game as well. There was one, Dele Alli in the second half, and I think there was the Diogo Jota one in the first half.
That is some save.
There's heaps of amazing saves.
Squared it to Kane. Kane should have buried it.
Great header as well.
He's firing, isn't he? Jota.
Yeah, he's been a good signing for him. That was the decision with Salah. The rules have been changed. Last season, that goal would not have counted. It would have been disallowed, because any handball in the lead up to a goal, immediately, whether it's intentional or non-intentional, it'd be scrapped off and cancelled out. But because it was unintentional, it was allowed to stand. So they've actually changed the rule in this season on that. So that's quite interesting.
That's interesting. People can try and get around that. I mean, it can't be impossible to make it look intentional.
Yeah. You know? So
I say Alisson was immense, and he came in a bit rashly there for Son to equalise, but you know, he can't have a perfect game. This looked like it was such an intense game.
Yeah, it really was, and there was a lot of big decisions really for the referee and the officiating staff to make, and I don't think they got all of them right personally. I think the Kane one definitely they got wrong. That should have been a red card. The two penalty decisions, I don't know if they've got them in the highlights, but there was one. Was this the Dele Alli one? No, this one. That was a good save from Alisson Becker. I don't know if they've got. That was a big chance missed by Kane. I think he missed. He probably missed about. I know he scored, but I think he missed sort of four or five big chances.
Story of his Euros, that was, wasn't it?
Really was. But I don't think they've even got the penalty shouts in the highlights.
It's unfortunate for Spurs, because this is a great result against Liverpool. And now they've just been eliminated from the Europa Conference. What's it called now?
The third tier of European football.
Is that what it is? Yeah. Is that what they got kicked out of? And it's because they forfeited the game and they lost 3-0, so they kicked them out.
Yeah.
Was that because of COVID stuff? Or?
I think so. And to be honest, I don't think they wanted to be in it anyway. Like, I don't think any English team is realistically going to use that as a sort of a realistic chance of winning, because they won't want to win it. I guess that would give them automatic place into the Europa League the following season, a bit like
how did Europa League does
for the Champions League.
How did they field a team here and not play against Real?
Yeah, it's quite strange.
Because Conte said he's going to sue him. He said he's going to sue the whoever makes these decisions. Is it UEFA?
Probably
or?
UEFA. Yeah.
When was that game supposed to take place?
Yesterday or the day before.
Really?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
That many people on the team caught COVID in that time?
Is it just like squad numbers in it? Like, we can't travel because too many people. They've got like 9 or 10 players that have got COVID.
Wow.
Allegedly.
I just don't think they wanted to be involved in that competition, really. Yeah. I don't think they wanted to from the start.
Forget it.
I think there was Brendan Rodgers was like, what is that league anyway? Like, he didn't even know much about it, do you know what I mean? So it's like, it's a bit of a, I don't really know why it's been introduced.
And the risk of travelling and risk of getting COVID out there.
Yeah, true. You don't want to like absolutely like a Tommy House up everyone there, do you know what I mean? Stay strong, Tommy, if you're listening. Stay strong, company man.
Well, let's move on to Arsenal Leeds then, because I don't know if you either saw the highlights of this game, but obviously Leeds' sort of miserable run continues. I think they shipped like 12 goals in 4 games. Obviously they got that hammered by Man City, and then really they got dismantled by Arsenal as well. Arsenal looks like probably the best I've seen them in a very, very long time. And we spoke about Arsenal in sort of like maybe 2-3 months ago, maybe 5-6 games into the season. We were like, could Arsenal really get relegated? I think after 8 games they hadn't won or something like that.
One of our famously bad calls, like,
yeah, famous bad takes from
Chael Sonnen's got the bad takes, we've got the real bad takes. To be fair, you can't really blame us or blame me for my scepticism, especially after that opening game against Brentford. They were dominated by them physically, like mentally. They just didn't look at the races at all. But we've covered this as well with Arteta and how he steadied the ship. And it's like what he said about Blues. I think he's looking to cut the deadwood out now. And I think he's starting to, especially with stripping the captaincy from Aubameyang. And Martinelli's been there a good few years, and he's never really got like a decent run in the team. And I think he's top quality, man. I honestly do. And he's shone in the game against Leeds.
Has that happened yet? Has he made the other dude captain now?
It's Lacazette, isn't it?
The guy he can use as a puppet.
And that seems to be working so far, doesn't it? Obviously, they beat Sunderland 5-1 last night. They had the young 18-year-old Charlie. Can't remember his surname now. Begins with P. He came on. 18-year-old scored. Yeah. Did so him? A player supposedly, or so I read, that was signed by Arsene Wenger. Yeah. For like a £10,000 compensation given to Luton or something as an 11-year-old or something.
Right.
So he's been with the club for a long time, and obviously, sort of watch this space with that one, because I think he looks like he's potentially going to be a good player. But Eddie Nketiah scored a hat trick.
He scored a hat trick, yeah. Getting into the semis now, the Carabao Cup, and it, which is good, and that's pretty much the level that Arsenal have been operating at for a good few years now. You got to celebrate any success you can get. Am I being a bit wistful and thinking, could Arsenal rebuild in the next few years under Arteta and challenge for top four again? Because that's the next stage to get to, really. Top four, that's all you can hope for, really.
They're fourth right now, aren't they? Well, they were the other day, I think.
Yeah, I think they're kind of cementing that position for themselves at the minute.
Could it happen this year, do you reckon?
Well, they're famously bad finishers to the season, Arsenal. It's like in their DNA as a team. They managed to falter over Christmas. It's like the fixture list is too hectic for them, and I think with their style of play you need to be on point mentally, and I think they tend to disintegrate with a lack of leadership quality in the team. That's been the case for the last few years anyway, so hopefully, man, I want to be proven wrong in all my doomsday predictions. I really do, but I don't know, it seems to be like they're in a transitional period, and I'll allow for them just finishing above wherever they finished last season. Was it 8th? 7th or 8th last season?
Is that the Ball Chats podcast official calling? We're saying, yeah. We're saying right now, put all the money, put the wife and the kids on it. We're finishing above 7th?
Above 7th. And watch them get relegated now.
I would say, I would agree with that. I think they'll definitely finish, they'll definitely be there at the end of the season.
Let's do it. Are you going to pick a number? What are you picking?
5th. I'll say 5th.
I'll go a tentative 6th.
Okay. I'll say 8th. They're going to be 8th.
Oh, screw.
Yeah, okay.
So no, I'll go 2nd. Go on, forget it.
I mean, you know, next couple of games are winnable, though. They got Norwich away.
Should smack them, really.
Should beat them. They got Wolves at home, so potentially they could get 6 points out.
Dodgy game, no Wolves.
Yeah, they've come into a little bit of form as well, I think, in recently. Wolves, they're looking quite difficult to beat. And then, obviously, they got a huge fixture against Man City.
Let's pull that back, because they beat us, was it 5-0 the last time we played them in August? And Arsenal can win those one-off games. They can pull a result out. I wouldn't fancy their chances in that game. No. A draw, I'd be happy with a draw from that one.
And then 2 weeks later, on the 16th, they've got Spurs away, which is going to be a huge game as well. And Spurs, really, you know, under Conte, they're going to be a team that probably they've set their sights on 4th. Like, because I don't think Chelsea, Liverpool, and Man City are really dropping out of those top 3 spaces. You just can't see it. Even though Chelsea are hitting a little bit of a wave,
they've been a bit in there.
So we'll see what happens with that. Whether Tuchel can sort of steady the ship and get them back to winning ways, but they are hitting a bit of a rough patch, really. But Liverpool and Man City, realistically, you can't see them losing three games from here until the end of the season, can you? So I think they're not going to be losing many games at all. Man City, who's going to beat them, really? Just
like Newcastle post-January.
Yeah, the surge. The absolute surge.
Trust me, it's coming.
But even the game, well, having Burnley at home, that's all right. But if that was away, I wouldn't fancy Arsenal. Like, I wouldn't bet a tenner on them to win that game away at Burnley. You know what I mean? So the fixture list has been pretty stacked against them early season, and now we're getting a nice little run here. It's time to put some 3 points together, man.
And we briefly spoke about Leeds last week and what's going on with them. And we were having a little bit of a conversation on the weekend, and it was a bit of a contrast, really, to how good Leeds were last season when they finished ninth, and sort of how bad Arsenal have been generally since then. And like, they look like polar opposites to the sort of teams that we've seen. Obviously, Leeds of last year and Arsenal at the start of the season. So we were talking about like tactics and how they differ between the Championship and the Premier League, because I found it funny that a lot of Championship teams now seem to be adopting the back three system. So they've got three defenders, they've got the two wing backs, and usually playing with a couple of midfielders with two up front. Whereas a lot of the Premier League teams, they seem to be adopting the back four. And on the weekend, me and you, Jim, we were speaking about like, I wonder if there's like a sort of like almost like the teams in Championship a couple of years away in terms of like the tactical sort of evolution, really, of the leagues, and whether the sort of better teams in this country are going with slightly different systems like 4-3-3, 4-2-3-1, which seems to be a system that a lot of teams were using sort of like 5 years ago. So there's a definite evolution sort of tactical ideas. And in the Championship, for some reason, they seem to be adopting that. But I do believe to play that system, you need to have good retainers of the ball.
Three at the back, you mean?
Yeah, I think, and because what happens, and what's happening with Blues a lot tactically, is they're getting murdered in the wide area. So every time a team comes against Blues, if you push the two wing backs up high, you're isolating those three back three. And we've got players that have no pace as well, which doesn't help. So every time,
chubby looking dude on that team,
George Friend, yeah. He just doesn't look like an athlete, does he?
Oh, Friend.
Couldn't keep up with anyone.
Looks like he should be a company man. Like, looks like he should be doing this. Should be stock trading, innit? Yeah, do you know what I mean?
I'd run him off the park, mate.
But honestly, what the teams do, they just put the ball into the wide areas. You know, isolate if they can, isolate players like George Friend, like Christian Pennison, who have got no pace whatsoever. And then they get beat one on one, so this spreads them. It either spreads them, or if they're gonna stay narrow, they're gonna give those wide players the ball and chances to put dangerous balls into the box. So
see, I would expect that three at the back and two wing backs, I would expect that to give you more width and more strength in the wide areas.
You would think so, but once if you lose the ball, if your wing backs push up and you lose the ball in midfield, any of those opposition players that find the pockets of space, like in behind the midfield and then the wing backs that are pushed up, can wreak havoc on those back three.
Would that be emphasised more with four at the back, though? Because doesn't the same problem exist if you pin the two full backs?
What Tomiyasu does for Arsenal, which I thought was brilliant, and they were showing sort of like the heat maps of different positions. The left back, Kieran Tierney, who had a great game against Leeds, he was bombing on. He was pushing forward. And what Tomiyasu would do, he would tuck in. So it's a if Tierney pushed forward, they'd have that sort of asymmetrical sort of like the Tomiyasu would stay back and protect, and then you'd probably have one of the midfielders of Arsenal would usually drop in. So you've always got that extra protection. And of course, you're talking about players that are operating on like light years of different levels to Blues as well, which always helps. And they might actually have some pace and not be like...
But that's the kind of defensive organisation that's the kind of defensive organisation that Arsenal have been lacking. Like, especially against the top teams, like they get found out. Literally, City, Liverpool, they will rip them apart in the middle of the field. So it's nice to see, from your observations at least, that they're starting to develop that kind of understanding, that kind of, okay, you go, I'll stay. That takes discipline, that takes concentration.
Yeah.
And it takes a willingness to maybe do the job that you don't want to do, the unglamorous job.
And I tell you what, I was really, really impressed with Tomiyasu. I think he has been a great, really, signing for Arsenal, because he came in and everyone was a bit like, who's this guy? Do you know what I mean? Japanese, I think he's about 24, never played the Premier League before. It was a bit like, you know, is that going to be a bit of a risky signing? But for me, he looked class. He absolutely dominated in the second start of the second half. And then he got took off after about 65 minutes when Arsenal were 4-0 up, I think, just to rest him. But he made a few like unbelievable interceptions, man. He looks so so physical. Like, not really quick, but, like, really, really strong, man. He was just bouncing Leeds players off him, man.
Mark G. Sung, Mark II.
You know what I mean?
Love it.
So, really, really impressed with him. We can. Do you want to talk about the Ashes for a little bit, or do you care? Or
you'd have to literally run us through what's happening.
You have to carry us through.
Yeah, I mean, you've been carrying us already, man. Your back must be killing you, mate.
But honestly, what's going on in the Ashes? England again, absolutely murked
in Australia,
like they do almost every time they go and play in Australia. So
fun.
I think they lost the second test now by sort of. I don't know how many runs was it Ashes second test, have a look, but it just looks like their woes with the bat are sort of like coming back to haunt them as well, even bringing in sort of Stuart Broad, James Anderson, the classic bowlers.
Who are the best batting men for England? Who are
the best batting men at the moment? There's only one batting man, that's Joe Root.
That's so I don't know who are the best batting men are, to be fair. So you'd have to just
it's so dumb. It's so funny.
So yeah, John Root's the one who's in the first test. He's the one that got bowled out straight away, isn't it? Is that Joe Root?
I think in the first inning, first ball.
Yeah. Is that him? Fuming, man. Absolutely fuming.
I don't actually know if it was. I haven't done enough research on him. Oh, that's just a fucking...
Now, just show us what's going on, because have they got any chance of coming back now?
Nah, I think they can still win. They can win 3-2. There's still three tests left. But, yeah, to take the Ashes, they would have to win the last three tests on the balance. Australia would only need to win the next one to win it. So, you know, second test, 275 run victory it was. And they took a 2-0 lead in the series. Like, basically, it's not looking good. And it hasn't looked good for a while, really, with the sort of England openers. And they're calling for a lot of criticism, I think. So there's going to be definitely a shake-up in the order.
Do they have, like, managers the way football teams have managers?
Who is the manager of England cricket team?
That's a niche question, that,
yeah,
isn't
it? It's a very niche.
That's a crossword question. Yeah.
I think the captains have a lot more responsibility, really, on the field. Like, it's quite important. They have to set up the field. They choose who's going to bowl how many overs. The captain makes decisions on that. So I feel like there's a lot more responsibility given to captains on the field, you know, that's probably one of the main difference between football and in cricket in that respect, is the fact that, yeah, the captain makes a lot of the decisions on the field. And obviously, Australia, they're a really good, they got a really good spinner called Nathan Lyon, I think.
Is that the one with the long arms, or this guy here?
Yeah, and I think what England really struggled with was, really causing Australia any kind of problem with spin. And I think, what was his name? Was he even one of the batting men was doing and the ball?
Classic. We're gonna get cancelled before we even get famous, right? Yeah. It's a shame that, like, look at the COVID restrictions. There's no one there. Man.
Yeah.
So about the you said the captains have a lot more responsibility. Do they take extra blame then if things go wrong the way a manager of football would?
Yeah, I think you're probably right in that respect. Yeah. I think Australia, that they change captaincies as well in the lead up to this. I think it's not. Yeah, I reckon we should sack this off. I'm trying to pull the knowledge out of my arse. It's not fucking coming. Man.
Abandon ship.
That's why. No, when you only have one line of, like,
England lose second test. Yes, they did.
There's a headline.
And some homophobic slurs thrown in there for good value.
You know what I mean? So let's just cut it all out, man. You know what I mean?
No, don't cut it out. Come on.
Let's go down with
the
ship.
Yeah, let's go down with the ship.
Right, let's do the five things you might miss then.
Cool.
Yeah. Top-ranked womaniser and golfing extraordinaire, Tiger Woods, was joined by his 12-year-old son, Charlie, on the course last weekend. And, like, he literally already looks like a pro. The father and son pairing shot their way to a second-place finish at the PNC Championship over the weekend, which was won by former PGA and Open Championship-winning golfer John Daly and his 18-year-old son. It's already looking like Charlie's going to be carrying his father's legacy in the future. But he's their mannerisms are like almost exactly the same. It's quite scary, really, to watch.
Did they celebrate in the strip club afterwards? Were they just like
probably, yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, cool. Him and Shooter McGavin and the boys.
Yeah, but honestly, some of the shots this kid was pulling out was crazy for a 12-year-old kid. I think, yeah, he's probably going to be winning like titles very, very, very soon, probably in the next sort of 5 years.
What I want to see is him going head to head with one of his bastard brothers, because there's going to be loads of them, isn't there? Some kid that Tiger's never acknowledged becomes amazing at golf and beats the air.
Yeah, it looks exactly like Tiger Woods. And it's just like, ooh, the evil sort of twin.
Yeah, the one from Baltimore with the dreads and the gold top.
This does actually remind me of Arnie, and I'm not even, it actually does. Did you hear about the kid he had with the maid? And the maid was like, oh, so I have a 15-year-old son and it's Arnie's. And Arnie's like, no way. And she released pictures of him, and it's definitely
his kid.
Big jaw, like huge jaw. He's like, that kid's not mine.
There's Arnold, another womanizer for you, man. Famous for it, like. He's got every chance in the world, hasn't he? Tiger's son. He's got the leg up, he's got the genetics, he's got the facilities, he's got the coaching, he's got the exposure. People are going to want him to do well. So yeah, he's going to get every chance and every opportunity.
Yeah, he almost has more chance of being successful than not being successful in a strange way. Do you know what I mean? Whereas, like, if we were going to start playing golf, like, it would be virtually impossible for us to get any good. He's already had all the sort of tools given to him to be successful from a very young age. And, you know, obviously it does help, like, you know, with such a famous name in golf. He's just going to, yeah, he's going to be there. You know for a fact he's going to be winning stuff in 10 years, I'd imagine, probably. You know what I mean? By the age of 22, if he's not winning majors, then...
Tiger Woods was a global phenomenon, wasn't he? And his fall from grace was spectacular. I'm waiting for that trajectory even more than his golfing success, to be honest.
Keep that's what I want.
Yeah.
But everyone's been, oh, it's been lovely to see him back on the course, like, after his sort of drink driving like incident. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's not a good dude, is he?
He doesn't strike me as being a very intelligent sort of person. Hasn't this happened more than once as well, like the drink driving thing and like the crash?
Well, who doesn't drive after a couple of lamb shandies, man?
Definitely. Yeah,
come on, lamb, it's Christmas, man.
It's Christmas. Was it Christmas for him like 6 months ago when he was like doing 120 after drinking like 8 vodkas and cokes or whatever?
Christmas
like,
is in your heart, man. Do you know what I mean? You carry that with you everywhere.
Renowned womanizer, Tiger Woods.
Right, number two, Aston Villa set for global exposure if Villa co-owners launch an MLS franchise touted to be named the Las Vegas Villains.
Quality.
Yeah.
Las Vegas have recently become a hotspot for a burgeoning new sports franchises, with the Raiders moving there just a few years ago, and also their hockey team, Vegas Golden Knights, were founded in 2017. Villa's billionaire owners, Wes Edens and Nassef Sawiris, already have expressed interest in an MLS franchise, and it looks like Vegas would be the likely spot. To be fair, like, Sin City now has sports, like a lot of different sports franchises. It just adds to the allure. It just makes you want to go, doesn't it? And go. And even having an MLS franchise, I think they'd probably sell out. I think they probably would sell out the first season.
Perfect place to have an ice hockey team in the middle of the desert.
I know.
Absolutely smashing it. It's like, we don't give a shit, bro.
Well, Tampa Bay Lightning have won back-to-back titles, haven't they? They're like in Florida. You wouldn't really expect it, really. But I suppose nowadays you just...
Are they a hockey team? Yeah. No idea. The Tampa Bay Lightning.
Yeah.
I like that name.
They won back-to-back titles, back-to-back Stanley Cups.
They just don't care, do they, man? They're franchises. They'll just move teams anywhere to anywhere. They just repackage it, just whatever. Foam fingers. It's like the start of basketball, isn't it? Like, it's literally like that.
And we can't really imagine that happening in the UK. Like, and we've had conversations in the past, and I've sort of like flirted with the idea of like there being like Manchester United would pack up and just go and like be in New York or something.
I'd love that.
Do you know what I mean?
It would piss so many
fans. Manchester Red Devils, like that. It's
like the old Pro Evolution games, isn't it? You remember the random names they used to give them?
Like Aragon, it was Barcelona, like Aragon or something. Like that. West Midlands Blue, when West Midlands Village.
Yeah, West Midlands Village.
I think West Midlands Village was Villa, right?
Village.
Yeah. You had to download the badges and the names and put them on your memory card, didn't you?
Yeah.
I can't remember, even know how you did. You used to have that on your memory card, didn't you?
Back when I was murdering people at Pro.
And they called Barcelona Aragon.
I think they were.
It's like the next state over.
Yeah.
That's so joked, man. But yeah, would that mean more income for Villa, or say like the owners of the franchise, the overall sports network? Could that possibly translate into more income for Villa, or do you think they compartmentalise?
Yeah, it would be, it'd be a little bit like what Man City are doing with is it Adelaide or Adelaide United? I think they've got partnerships with obviously New York City FC,
New York City,
and they've also got a team. I think they've got a team over in Asia as well. So it's kind of like they'd be like sister teams, I suppose, and they'd probably be able to send players on loan and stuff like that. Whereas where Pat Patriera did, he sort of like. I think he went over to NYCFC and did sort of like coaching there, so like get experience. So they might do it with coaches, they might do it with players, you know, ship players out onto these different places. So I imagine Villa would do something very, very similar. So it'd be under the same kind of umbrella. So they're almost trying to create a brand, like a Aston Villa brand, which is quite interesting, really.
Really unfashionable. But they are Tom Hanks' favourite team, and David
Cameron as well.
And David Cameron as well.
Prince William was at the game. I think he was at the Norwich game. My mum always tells me that because, you know, she's Tory and royal family and that.
Royal family and that.
Did you see? Yeah, she's so proud of it. Oh, Prince William's a Villa fan.
He was throwing Illuminati signs like. Oh.
Yeah.
over.
I love the whole Illuminati conspiracy. Why would you put all of your signs everywhere? Like, you're meant to be secret.
I've watched videos where it's like, look, if you look, examine this footage from this angle, you can see his reptilian features coming up. It's like, mate, go to sleep.
Hobo, a mate of ours, for anyone listening, Hobo made a YouTube channel about 10 years ago doing these sorts of videos. They're obviously all fake, and he actually got a bit of a following. People really respected him. He was like the UK's leading reptilian expert for a bit.
Do you remember he wrote about Flynn?
One title.
Do you remember he did that like short series or something, or like it was something about Finn, and he's called him Xander Starchild.
That's the channel.
Is so funny, man. Literally created this fictional character based on a real guy, like just changed his name and called him Xander Starchild.
Anyway, we can sort of build a partnership with him. Like, you know what I mean? We should try and grow each other's fan base.
Let's get him on.
Talk about reptiles and sport or something.
The Tampa Bay Lizard.
Alright, so number three. This is a pretty funny one. Proper shit towers, really. Non-league outfit Sydenham United spelt out their team sheet to say SRFC are shit. So like literally 1 to 11, the first letter of each name. It was like Scott somebody, and then it would be like Ryan this, like Frank this. You know what I mean? SRFC are shit. Against their game against Streatham and Rovers last week, much to the disgust of the fans, really. They were moaning about it on Twitter. The away side, they're based in South London, and they said on their Twitter account that they clocked what Streatham had done because Dane Francis, who plays as a striker, was wearing number 3, so they shifted him up so he'd fit the acronym. Obviously, here on the Ball Chat Sports Podcast, we absolutely condone shit.
Yeah, of course. But who was moaning about that?
It was somebody was like, well, we know they've done that. We know, he plays a striker, he's playing number 3.
You're not respecting the game.
So did they have to put like the striker in defence or something? Completely ruin their tactics for the joke?
Yeah, just that would be even better if they had to do that. Because obviously three is usually your left back in it, but obviously like, They might care about the number system, but like in the Premier League, you don't, because you've got like a million players and it's just, you've got players wearing like number 78 or whatever. But yeah, he didn't have to play left back now.
That would have been amazing.
He just would have been a bit odd, a striker wearing number 3. You don't really see it very often at all.
And the keeper was in midfield as well, which is nice.
I love that commitment to the bit. The janitors are like, we need a dude with R. Come on,
Rob! Get him.
Alright, number 4, 25-year-old Willie Borland had the night of his life when he threw a 9-darter to finish his debut match at the Ali Pali. Borland is only the 9th different player to achieve perfection at the PDC World Championship. And I think there has been a 10th, I think there's one the other day as well that got a 9-darter. Raymond van Barneveld and Adrian Lewis have both done it twice apiece. This is absolute scenes. You should watch. Have you watched this?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
Have you guys ever gone to see the darts live?
Nah, I don't think I'd survive. I don't think I'd survive.
Everyone's just absolutely getting stoned.
All in fancy dress, dressed as bananas and Super Mario and that.
Oh,
And that was just the first three legs, first three darts, haven't it?
Who are these nippers, man? Is it the youth championship?
Yeah, he looks about 15, doesn't he, the geezer? Good covers. He's fighting to
stay in, keeping distance. This guy looks an ag.
That's an athlete.
Yeah.
That is an athlete.
Student athlete.
Deciding leg, that's all it is. Is it an American commentator?
Yeah, might be, yeah.
Zarge.
I think he's Canadian, I think it might be John Park.
Pure darts!
He's the king of the world, isn't he? Right there, man.
What way to finish the game as well. And he's baby.
They're going mental, aren't they, man? The guy, his opponent's trying to congratulate him. He's not even paying any attention to him.
He's in the moment there. We've got to go to something like this, guys.
He's the Beethoven of the darts world.
Absolutely smashed it. But yeah, to be fair, it's one of those sporting moments that has like a real crescendo of like intensity. And it's like, oh, he's going to do it. Is he going to do it? But it's like when they miss the last dart, it's so hilarious. Everyone just like,
they probably everyone still sing that tune, don't they?
Yeah, but it's still probably going. All right, but yeah, and finally, I sent you this on the chat the other day. FIFA's member associations have been told that a biennial World Cup would generate $3.3 billion in additional income over a 4-year cycle. So that's that then, isn't it?
It's absolutely going to happen. You can set your watch to that. Give it like after the Qatar one, it's going to happen, isn't it?
Look, money's not our only interest. It's what the fans want.
They're going to come up with a slew of reasons why it's good for it and just never talk about the money. That's what they're going to do. Oh, it's just good for competition. Oh, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I think Infantino, the president, he's already come out and said, oh, it's going to be good for the lesser teams and this and that. And it's really going to generate a little bit more interest and sort of prop up. It's not going to be like the European Super League. It's going to be much, much better. And it's not going to sort of like, be elitist and sort of...
Unusual company man stance for Tino there. Yeah, good on him. Big shout out to you there, Tino.
You've been indoctrinating him.
I have, yeah.
You're a great chat
material. But I'm all for the biannual World Cup. I love the World Cup. It's awesome. I want more of it.
But I think the idea is that it would kind of like dilute the competition a little bit, and also UEFA and CONMEBOL and the African Cup of Nations, which no one cares about, but like
Africans,
Africa's not that big though, is it?
A couple billion dudes.
All these other federations that have their, but to be fair, African Cup of Nations is biannual anyway. But the whole point is, it's just going to take away the sort of like the attention on the sort of European competition.
Isn't that 4-year span, the gap between World Cups? It's kind of arbitrary anyway. Like, it just started off at being 4. Like, what's to say it has to be 4 the whole thing? As is tradition.
But then what do you do with the sort of like Nations League and friendlies? And
get rid of all of it. We hate all that stuff.
The Euros. Yeah, I know. But I think the Nations League, I think that's got potential. And obviously England have been drew in a group with Germany, Italy and Hungary, I believe, for the Nations group. So I'm actually quite looking forward to those games, even though they would have been friendlies. Mm-hmm. We used to hate international friendlies. Like when we spoke about this a few weeks ago and sort of like where are the real advantages and disadvantages with sort of playing international friendlies and also qualifiers such as like San Marino. Mm-hmm. Etc. But I think that the Nations League, I think that's starting to get to a point where it is generating a bit more interest because it's sort of like promotion relegation, isn't it? And if you win that, you get an automatic place in the World Cup. So,
but I didn't even realise, was it France that won the Nations League this time?
It would be Portugal 3-2, didn't
I
they?
Didn't even know what was like it was happening or what was going on. I didn't realise the significance of it. It didn't even register as something on my radar at all.
I think it's only been around for 2 years though, but I think that's the good way to take away sort of international friendlies, and that's a good way to make it a little bit more competitive. It does feel like a little bit more competitive now with those, but I'm not sure what would happen with that should the World Cup be every 2 years, because literally qualifying lasts usually, like World Cup qualifying lasts like how long? Like 2 years, isn't it? It's like they spread the games out, don't they? So it'd be like World Cup finishes and then they'd have to start the qualifying like months after.
Yeah.
You'd assume.
And they do that for the Euros anyway, don't they?
Yeah.
It starts. It goes concurrently because Euros, then World Cup. The qualifiers just start immediately anyway. So.
And I don't think there's an issue with diluting the product. We know like what a product football is to the world. Do you know what I mean? It's the best sporting package that you can possibly imagine.
People can't get enough of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the World Cup is the best of that best package for me. And you can never have too much of a good thing. Do you know what I mean?
famous last words.
Says he who's been, been fucking wallowing in his pit all day, absolutely fucking decaying in bed. Like, do you know what I mean?
Just about you can't have too much of a good thing. Just give me the rest of that crack, mate.
It's like heroin in the World Cup.
There's literally no downside.
It's a bit Moorish, that's it.
And just because we've done absolutely fucking no preparation this week. we're gonna not do the quiz.
Nah, the people want a quiz. Let's put something out of our ass.
I've got a book here. Dance with Dragons 2, Part 2. Do you want a couple of questions? Oh no, we can't subject them to a haphazard quiz.
Yeah, you can't just go like, oh, quiz questions on the phone. Like,
that's literally what Flynn's doing.
How about I find something? If it takes a second, we can always snip it out.
Yeah.
But I'll just find.
Football yearbook 2003-2004. We don't want to mess with that because he'll know everything about that. That's like that's his year. That's his prime year.
That is my era, man.
That is when you peaked.
That was your peak, man. Like your hot streak. That is.
God bless the hot streak.
No, fuck it. Should we just do the combat sports?
Let's do the combat sports.
Fuck it. Go on then, Jim.
Yeah. So UFC fight night at the Apex last Saturday. Saw Stephen Thompson drop a wide 3-round decision to Bilal Muhammad. That's the guy that got poked in the eye by Leon Edwards.
So is he gonna go fight him now? Because I quite like Bilal Muhammad. I think he rose up the ranks quite quickly, hasn't he, as well? Do you think that's the next fight for him, Leon Edwards rematch?
He made the point that he wants the title shot now. He said that he's beat Damian Maia, he's beat Stephen Thompson in a way that no one else is beaten, but Gilbert Burns just did a similar job on him. I don't feel like Bilal Muhammad has that kind of cachet just yet. I think he's probably gonna have to wait in line. I don't know what's next up for Usman. Is it? He's just beat Covington. He's done Masvidal twice. Hopefully the Leon Edwards fight happens, but I don't know.
Jake Paul wants him, doesn't he? he wants Kamaru Usman,
the greatest fighter of our times. Yeah. I stand by that.
And we're going to talk about that geezer in a little bit.
A once in a generation combat sports athlete. But yeah, it was kind of it's a surprising thing to see Stephen Thompson finally come to the end of what's been quite an impressive career. He had those two fights with Tyron Woodley a few years ago. The first one of those was spectacular. I think he was like 55-0 undefeated as a kickboxer before he came to the UFC. He's been lighting up people with like those mad spinning kicks and that karate/kickboxing style. And it looks like he's coming to the end now of being competitive at the top flight in the UFC. So, especially that clash of styles, that striking versus wrestling dynamic, it looks like people are starting to figure him out now. In the main event, Derek Lewis, he got his first win since losing to Cyril Gane. Gane.
Where's he from?
He's from France.
Yeah.
Oh, it could be Gunn. Maybe with the East side.
So Gunn's the interim champion. Francis Ngannou is the proper champion, and they're going to unify their belts sometime in February.
February, which is that's going to be a monstrous affair, really, isn't it?
Yeah. But Derek Lewis has beat Francis Ngannou in one of the worst fights I've ever seen, and Cyril Gane, he's just schooled Derek Lewis a couple of weeks ago. So Derek Lewis is back at maybe top two or three in the rankings now after knocking out Chris Daukaus in the first round. But do I see him beating either of the quote-unquote champions at the moment? Not really. But I can see him getting another shot sometime soon. Absolutely. That power is unreal, especially in the first... and that's the first time I've used the phrase unreal on this podcast. I used it about 15 times last week. It was doing my head in when I was listening back. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. The major fight from last week, which what we was all talking about in the pub for ages yesterday, was Derek Chisora versus Joseph Parker.
Amazing.
And another famous ball chat call last week. I was like, I don't know why they're having this rematch. I'm not interested in it. I could barely remember the result. And all of us, in every group chat I'm involved in, it was lit up. It was an amazing fight.
Yeah, it really was.
Joseph Parker looked on point, especially in the early rounds. He had that low stance, looked very sharp, and he looked like he had a game plan coming in there. Basically, the uppercut to catch Derek Chisora coming in, and he dropped him three times with the uppercut. I think it was the fourth round, the seventh round, and the eighth round. The last one was a little bit contentious for me because I think even though it was a good shot that landed, I think he pushed him afterwards. And whether or not Derek Chisora would have gone down from that uppercut is immaterial. He got pushed to the ropes, and I don't think that should have been counted. But the overall performance from Parker, I think he dominated the fight. I know Derek Chisora was game. He took a lot of punishment, but he managed to rally in spots where you thought the fight was over loads and loads of times. Then he would just come out swinging. You mentioned before, but after one of the rounds, he's just screaming war in Joseph Parker's face. And yeah. He's like, what is this guy
doing? I think that might have been, was that the first time he got knocked down? He got to his feet. And every time, and we spoke last night in the pub, we spoke about Joseph Parker's perceived inability to finish. And that was part and parcel down to what Chisora was doing when he got back to his feet. To give himself that extra time, he'd sort of like creep into the corner, do you know what I mean? And then just wait for Parker to throw a punch, and he'd dodge it. And he did that really well. And then that's what gave him that late flurry, and then screaming war in his face. Just, I think everybody, no matter whether you bet on Parker or you wanted Parker to win at the start of the fight, I think everybody watching that, you'd be alive if you said you didn't want Chisora to win.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely in the middle of the fight. Because he just showed so much heart, man.
And so much CTE as a result of
that. Yeah, oh, yeah. He's going to be blowing raspberries, man.
I've got a maybe a hot take. Loved watching Chisora. Definitely enjoyable to watch him. But was he really that good a boxer?
It depends what you mean. Like,
he's a journeyman, and we used the word journeyman and bandied it around a little bit too much. But would you put him in the class of journeyman?
Well, I don't think you could call him a journeyman because you have to beat Chisora. I mean, he's had a few off nights where he's had points decisions against him. Against, I think it was for the heavyweight European title a few years ago, against a French lad, I can't remember his name. But that's one of the few occasions where he hasn't really shown up and like, okay, that was an underwhelming performance. But if you look through his resume, he's got wins over Robert Hellenius, who's having... and he's got the win, but didn't get it on the points, on the decision, sorry. So he's basically beaten Robert Hellenius, who's just had a late career surge, knocking out that that Polish guy. Is he Big Baby, the big fat ball guy. And he went toe-to-toe with Vitaly Klitschko, fought David Hay, got sparked, but put Hay under a lot of pressure in that fight. Fought Tyson Fury twice, gave him a good run the first time, but Fury spanked him the second time. He knocked out Carlos Takam. He knocked out Artur Spilker. These are like top 10 heavyweights in anyone's estimation.
And so, Takam looks... Takam, if I remember right, he looked really good against Andy Joshua. I think he fought him in, was it 2016, 2017, something around, like that.
Yeah.
And he was one of the first fighters, if I remember rightly, that caused him some problems, Andy Joshua. So
yeah, that was a bit of a bullshit stoppage as well. I think he stopped him on his feet. He was a bit like, he didn't really seem that hurt, but Chisora sparked him out.
Mm.
And he was battering Chisora that whole fight as well. So it seems that, and bear in mind, he gave Usyk a lot of problems as well. And Usyk is just schooled AJ. So it's like, he's not a journeyman, but he's very limited technically. And he depends on his toughness, maybe a little bit too much, as we've seen against Parker. But those scorecards were outrageous. We talked about it before, one was 115, 110, 140. They were so close that if Parker didn't score the knockdowns, Chisora would have won the fight.
Yeah, 114, 112. And there's no way you can give like 8 rounds to Chisora. It's just like... beyond, it's unfathomable. Like, honestly, it really is.
Impossible.
Yeah, you have to give Parker at least 8 rounds. And that's if you're being generous, isn't it?
Parker was really sharp. He was like tripping up on the left hook, like catching with the jab, and like very defensively aware, very defensively alert, because you know Chisora's just gonna come with the playground one bombs, man, when he gets hurt. Do you know what I mean? So, and I think that's the best I've ever seen Parker look. And if he carries on fighting like that and improving as he has in his short stint with Andy Lee, I think we'll get to see something like... I would like to see the AJ rematch if AJ, you know, doesn't fight... I don't know what's happening with AJ and Usyk now.
But I've been reading that Usyk's, like, looking better than he was when he fought him the first time. Like,
that's frightening,
so,
isn't it?
Yeah.
then I've been reading a lot about what people think of Parker, and one thing that keeps coming up is no one seems to think he'll be any good against the top lads of the division. Do you reckon?
Well, he's in, I think he trains with Tyson Fury now.
Oh, he does?
Yeah, so I think his trainer is Andy Lee. Andy Lee is the guy that facilitated Tyson Fury's hookup with Sugar Hill steward. And it's just like, there's a definite connection there. I don't know if they're in the same gym day in, day out, but they definitely have trained together. And I don't know if that fight would happen for that reason. But if it did, I think Fury would absolutely spank him. Just, you know.
Wilder too?
Oh, that's a good fight, man. Mm. I think Wilder might retire soon, you know. That's what he's saying. Well, wouldn't you? He's just been through hell. Like, that fight was... It would make you reassess your options in life.
No, it was brutal. And to be honest,
to get a real job.
Yeah, forget it.
Where does Dillian Whyte sit in all this as well? Because, like, obviously, I think... Did he get ordered the mandatory with... I thought he was going to get...
Against Fury.
Against Fury, yeah.
And
what's happening with that?
I forgot to mention the fight with Dillian Whyte for Derek Chisora. He pushed him all the way in that first fight. And Dillian Whyte pulled out a really nice knockout in the second fight in the 11th round.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's been mandated to fight Tyson Fury in February, I think. And he was the WBC mandatory for like 3.5 years. And they just left him sitting there when Wilder had the title. Just pure political. I don't know what was going on. Because personally, I think Wilder would have beat him. So I don't know what the problem was there. Why?
But they're more focused on trying to build up the Fury versus AJ sort of fight and trying to sort of like, you know, get the machinations in place for that.
Yeah.
That they weren't really thinking about White.
Well, look at what they've done with Canelo. They've just let him jump up two divisions to fight Makabu. And I think they just do what they want. They don't even pretend to follow their own rules. They don't give a shit, so...
I don't blame him. I want exciting fights.
Yeah, yeah, same. Let's not.
Also, you need to give like the guys that have fought their way into positions. You need to give them their fair shot.
What's your like rankings? Yeah, what I don't like about it is why even pretend? But like, why have rankings? Why have the appearance of objectivity if you're just gonna do what you want?
Exactly. I don't think even in the UFC, I feel at least they just kind of loosely, Dana White loosely follows the rankings. And I think you'll find that, like, you know, when somebody gets up to sort of like third and then they become the challenger or the interim sort of like.
Unless your name's Leon Edwards.
Yeah, unless your name, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's been fucked over as well. Brummy.
Fellow Brummy. I feel for him.
Slack. Uncle Dana and his steroid head holding it down.
The Martian, man. Yeah.
I've got, seeing as we're just about to leave the subject of Chisora, I've got a mini quiz question I found.
Go on.
Yeah? Who's going to go first?
Bissett.
Alright, so, I want to know, when did Chisora make his professional debut? What year?
So, he's probably, what is he, 34?
He knows his age. He's
younger than I thought he was. He's 37?
Yeah, and I can say I'm 21. Don't make it true.
His professional debut. Let's go 12 years ago. Let's go 2008.
2008, okay. And Jim?
2010. I'll go 2010.
Got to go to Bissett. 2007. Well done, man. Boo. Well done.
Should have got that one, really.
And bonus point, who did he fight? Who did he beat?
In his debut?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even going to hazard a guess.
Mark Potter?
No idea how to pronounce this dude's name. He's from Hungary.
And of course he is.
István Kekskes.
Oh, the old Kekskes. The old Hungarian bomber. Yeah.
Right, so should we talk about the Jake Paul versus Tyron Woodley, whether it's a fix or not? Because Tino... And all the conspiracy, all the conspiracy bandwagoners, that they want to believe that this was all planned, and that, you know, and Jake Paul was sort of giving Tyron Woodley messages with his arm, twisting his glove, and then delivered the most like harrowing blow I've seen all year. So if that's a fix, and Tyron Woodley's agreed to take one of those, then I feel sorry for the geezer. Well,
the best was I said. If Woodley is able to give that appearance of being knocked out, he should get a job as a stuntman. And then Pizzy put in the group chat, yeah, he's actually been a stuntman in loads of different films. So I was like, well, maybe. But then I watched it several times. There's no way that's a fix. It's a clean shot. It showed him the right hand to the body, went over the top. Woodley bit on the feint, and it was a subtle feint as well, because the phase before that, he feinted in with his whole body, and just to see what Woodley would do, he backed off, he went for the same phase again, but then he committed to the overhand right, the sweat flew everywhere, and Woodley went face down.
And, yeah, face down. If you're conscious, or if it was a fix, you can't stop putting your hands out to protect your face when you're falling.
Yeah, it's subconscious, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
I don't think you can train out of someone unless you're a trained stuntman.
So
I think he's had a 60-day suspension as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, medical suspension. Yeah.
Well, you have to, isn't it? If you get chin like that, it's not good. But we mentioned, we've got a lot of admiration for Jake Paul's trolling, continuous trolling of Tommy Fury throughout the build-up to the fight, wearing the T-shirt saying, "This could be you, Tommy," and all that kind of stuff. And what was the thing on his robe? This could be you, but it's cool to watch it on TV as well.
On a Union Jack robe.
What a legend.
So, you have to commend his ability to, like, wind people off, man. And obviously, the kid's, what, 24, 25 years old. He's got more money than most people can ever imagine. And he's out here, and he's 5-0, and he's beating UFC welterweight champions. And, like, at the end of the day, you can't deny him. Like, no, when he first came in, it was like, all right, this is going to be a bit of a, it sounds like it's going to be a bit of a joke. And he was fighting geezers that never fought anyway. Like, I think he fought like an ex-NFL player that came in and had one fight.
Yeah, it was a basketballer, I think it was.
And a basketballer. Nate Robinson.
Flattened him as well. Yeah.
He's knocked out. He says he's knocked out everyone he's fought now.
Yeah, but then Ben Askren came in, and then he was like, right, now we're starting to take him a little bit seriously. The fight wasn't great, like, up until the knockout, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think, like, Woodley looked a horrible boxer, to be honest, and he wasn't listening to anything that his corner was telling him, man.
It's difficult for Woodley because he was a good striker in MMA, but punching, the boxing component of mixed martial arts, is just a different way of boxing than it is when you've got a straight pugilistic match. And because he was drawn in late from the Tommy Fury replacement, I don't think he had that much of a training camp. I think he hurt Jake Paul in the first fight as well, and I think he was probably relying on that a little bit. Like, he was a bit too patient in that first fight, and here he's probably got a little bit overconfident, really. But, you know, I think Jake Paul to faint and drop one over the top, that's like actual boxing moves. So, and like you say, this is a guy with Tyron Woodley, like 5-6 title defenses, like a 30-yard fight career. You know, you can't underestimate that achievement at all. And I know Jake Paul's younger, he's got the size advantage, this, that, and the other. But he still knocked him out. Yeah. You know what I mean? I'm actually looking forward to seeing what happens next. I wonder if the Tommy Fury fight will actually happen.
Yeah, the intrigue's there now. I wonder, yeah, as you say, did Tommy Fury really want that fight? Did he want that heat?
Did he want that smoky smoke?
He looked worried in them press conferences, though.
Yeah, you reckon he was looking a bit worried.
He looked shady, yeah.
No wonder he broke a rib. Did you see what, like, his dad was doing? Like, smashing something against
the
his
medicine
chest.
Ball.
Yeah, the medicine ball against his chest.
Well, I've seen Tyson Fury train, and the dad and his training partners do that to him, and he's like, "Come on, harder, break a rib." I think they thought Tommy could probably take that.
Clearly not.
That training method. I read somewhere that Joe Frazier, the great heavyweight from the '70s, his trainer used to do that to him, and it turned out it gave him like organ damage. It's like not the one at all.
I can't imagine. It's a very sensible way to train.
I understand, like, toughening up the area, but I think I've seen Chris Eubank Jr. and his trainers. They kind of do like with wooden sticks, like really dense wooden sticks, like kind of wrapping on the area like a glockenspiel, like just tenderizing the area and building up that resistance kind of thing. I can understand that method. That smashing a medicine ball off your rib cage. Hit me harder! Hit me harder! I love it! Oh, it's too hard, mate! I'm out of the fight.
Well, we spoke about about the difference between sort of like Tommy and like his dad and obviously Tyson. And like Tyson and his dad are like spitting images at each other, and you got Tommy, who's just like really like good looking lad, and we were like, "There's no way he's from the same mom, no way." And I think we looked at him, and
he's not.
Yeah, yeah.
Like we said the other day, he probably just wanted to go to art school or something.
Yeah. No, you're a fighting man.
Nope, get in the ring, lad. Yeah, and there's got to be an unreal amount of pressure to live up to those expectations. I think all of Tyson Fury's brothers have had one or two professional bouts. I've seen one of them fight, actually, in Derby. And it seems to be like, obviously the traveller community and all that, boxing's like a massive part of their culture, but maybe just like, maybe just allow it, Tommy, if you're not that into it. Like, you can't, no, look, I'm not even being funny. If it's not what you're into and you're there to try and kind of fulfill expectations that aren't even there for you, mm-hmm. those are probably not the best motivations, like the right driving factors to go for. So I want to see what he can do, but I don't know if he'll fight Jake Paul. I'm not really not sure about that.
You don't want the smoke. Yeah, Jake Paul's the guy now. Yeah, He's revived boxing. He's the Phoenix.
Muhammad Ali 2.0.
And obviously, post-fight, he's come out and I think he called, not called out, but what did he say about Dana White and the UFC? He said he embarrassed...
Your whole company.
Yeah, you embarrassed your whole company. I wouldn't quite go that far. He's calling out Kamaru Usman. I think that's...
But you know what he said? He said that he offered, I don't know if it was Nate Diaz or Usman, he said, I'll offer you $5 million and pay-per-view points to come and fight me on it. That's crazy.
To be fair, Nate Diaz, like, and I think he deserves that as well, because I don't suppose he's made that much money in his career, and he's been such a legendary fighter for so long. But that'd be a different kettle of fish for him.
So much scar tissue on that face, though. I could see him cutting up, you know. I could see a hard jab or something just splitting him wide open. And you could stop him on that level.
Yeah.
Like, the momentum's with Jake Paul now. The universe is like in his corner, basically.
He's polarized. He's so polarized. He had 20,000 sellout in wherever it was, Tampa Bay. Mm-hmm. And you know, you had 10,000 people booing him and 10,000 people cheering him, man. He's just creating this absolute like pantomime, isn't it?
That's the sweet spot, though.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It really is.
He's a marketing genius, though, to be fair to him. I saw an interview with famous boxing promoter Hearn.
Is it? Yeah, Slimy Eddie Hearn.
Yeah. And he was saying about
Slimes
won't be able to hear this in China. No chance can he get on Spotify. So you know how he was supposed to fight Fury? He pulled out, and before any of us ever found out, he already got Woodley ready for that fight. And Eddie Hearn reckoned he probably had 2 days max to get that sorted, and he did. He's a big respect to him. He's a good businessman.
Yeah.
Good company, man.
If he retires undefeated, he can just dine out and that forever, can't he? Undefeated boxer, like. And then just go back to whatever he was doing before, just YouTube.
Yeah, at the age of 30, like, do you know what I mean? And just make another few billions, like.
Should we put him on our first Ball Chat t-shirt? Forget Mike Tyson.
Tino disowned us, man, to be fair.
Picture of him knocking Tyson out.
He
beats Tyson when he's like 65. Like.
Standing over Tyson's prone body.
But we'll have. Should we have a quick word on what's going on with Hamzat Chimaev?
Yeah. Kobe Covington.
That was it. They another rumour about him. Another rumour, not confirmed yet, but Kobe Covington, yeah.
I mean, would you say, is that too much of a jump? Is that too much too soon for this absolute psychopath?
I heard Uncle Dana saying that no one's excited to take the Khamzat fight at all. Mm-hmm. Like, up and down the ranks.
Fully imagine, man.
What's the upside to fighting him? Like, he's ranked, I don't know where he's ranked. I think he's pretty low in the rankings. But if you're a top 5, top 10 guy, and you see what he's been doing so far, where is the upside? Everyone's like, yeah, you should wait in line like the rest of us did. Yeah, I'd be fucking saying that as well, mate.
Yeah.
For he picks me up and drops me on my head or chatting shit to Dana, like, get off your phone.
For he shoots me in the ring.
Pick you up on the black car, like, do you know what I mean?
So, I didn't think Covington started that last fight with Usman that well. And I think that if he starts off like that against Khamzat, he'll be in trouble straight away. Because he's got a serious killer instinct. He's not messing about. He wants to finish that fight as soon as possible, by any means. So, and he's an absolute psycho, man. Do you know what I mean? So I wouldn't, if I was a welterweight or even a middleweight right now, I'd be thinking, yeah, maybe leave it, man. I might just sit on my ranking for a little bit.
I think this is going to be my hot take on Hamzat. I think we might see a death from him in the ring. You look in his eyes, it looks like not much is happening behind him. Like, if it was medieval times and I was a king, he would be my top boy.
Yeah, he'd be on the hand. Field,
get hand, out there and just murder people who need to be murdered.
And good. Military general.
He's like scorched off, like, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Burn down their farms. Yeah. The lot, you know.
He just closes his visor. It's like straight on it, like straight onto his horse.
Something like right with that dude's eyes, man. So there's my hot take for him. But I love him. Amazing athlete, though. He's incredible.
Yeah, he's really sort of like whetting the appetite of that division, I think. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Just like He just come out of nowhere as well, really, hasn't he?
Nowhere.
The Chechen Wolf, man. Oh my gosh. What a lad. Oh, that area of the world just breeds killers, man. And
Dagestanis, killer. Man.
Dagestanis, Chechens, the Caucasus, the Mongolian steppe. Lads with rock hard heads and cardio for days.
Fighting bears.
Yeah,
fighting bears. So what is it like? There's going to be a couple of things going on. It's super mountainous. So obviously, you just probably grow up to be quite fit, walk into the shop up the mountains. I mean, largely Muslim countries, so they're not drinking a lot, the dudes who live there. And that's obviously going to lend itself to training a lot. What else?
Quite impoverished as well. So I think you're always going to have like determination there in it and like adversity that's built. And I think with fighters, I think that's really, really important for fighters, isn't it?
I think you can't overlook the Soviet influence either in terms of their wrestling and that, because they've got a serious physical culture there. Yeah. And, you know, like the whole Olympic program, and the Soviets were mad for all that, weren't they? So there's got to be that kind of legacy there as well. But obviously, there's mad like wrestling, like thousands of years old, like types of wrestling all over the world, like Turkish, like Greece wrestling and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it seems to me that because it's so isolated in those areas, so impoverished, there's nothing to do, can't get on the session because it's against your religion, kind of. You may as well just get sick of fighting, you know what I mean? And now the avenue's there, the gyms are there, and they're getting filtered into all these organisations. It's great to see, man. So,
yeah.
More power to them. But that's like a fairly light episode this week, isn't it?
It's fine, boy, really. It's still an hour and 20 minutes, though.
We content-wise.
Out of our arseholes, well done.
Let's give each other a big old pat on the back. But
pat on the arsehole.
But yes, that's going to be our last one before Christmas. Obviously, we're coming on to a year since we started our podcast. That's going to be, you know, we started in January 2020, or January this year, rather. And so it's been a fantastic year, and great to have you on the podcast now as well, Flynn.
Cheers. Yeah, thanks for bringing me.
Big shout out to all our listeners. Hope you all have a great Christmas.
I hope you have a shit one.
Especially if you support Blues. We'll come into the Blues, aren't we?
Yeah, we're going to the Blues. Yeah. I will definitely bring a book, man. 100%.
And to be honest, new year, hopefully we're going to look to be a bit more, how can I say, active on social media and starting to do little, like, different things. Maybe get a few videos up and stuff like that as well.
A few articles as well, maybe. A few long form articles. Once uni finishes, I'll have a lot of time on my hands and I want to do some properly referenced in-depth, like a couple thousand worders, for just to tick that kind of box as well. Different forms of content for the things that we like covering.
For sure, yeah, because we want to keep it rolling.
Big ball chat media empire.
Definitely.
And what are we saying about next week being the end of year best highlights of the year in the world of sport?
Yeah, we're going to have to try and trawl through all our previous episodes and pick out some.
Or we could just do best bits from actual, not our best bits, because we haven't got that many best bits.
Just like sporting best bits.
Yeah. Best knockouts.
Jake Paul, obviously.
Yeah.
We've got that one sewn in.
People to look out for next year. You know, we could do it month by month. All right, let's talk about what happened in sport in January. You know, what happened in February.
What a man to have on board, Flynn. What a man.
Got the format solid for next week then. Yeah,
I could do something like that. Right. Maybe quizzes.
Cheers for listening. Thank you very much. And we'll see everyone, or see you two next week.
You'll see me on Friday, mate.
I'll see you tomorrow, probably.
I'll see you in the pub in 20 minutes.